Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to The Vanished ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or Apple Podcasts.
She packed her bag and she walked out of the house. Now, that's not too nothing crazy out of the ordinary. And she gets picked up by a bus and takes that bus from our town of Monroe to the neighboring town, which would be Snohomish. And we know she did that because we have video footage of her getting on the bus. I know it's my sister and we know it's her. She's on her phone on the bus and we have her all the way to Snohomish and we have her get off the bus. My mom has talked to everybody. Our whole family has. My dad, too. My mom was able to talk to Bickford Ford, is the dealership right there next to the bus stop she got up at. And so my mom hopped right on it, talked to that Bickford owner dealer. They're great people at that Ford dealership. And so they sent that footage right over. And we have footage of her, Kenna, walking down the street towards this big, I guess, like store area. There's a Fred Meyer there. There's a Kohl's. There's all these restaurants.
On March 31st, 2020, 25-year-old Kenna Harris packed her backpack with her medications, a yoga mat, and some other belongings. Then she left her Monroe, Washington home. As you learned in part one of Kenna's story, she was due to report to her shift at a local Walmart. She usually took a bus to that location, but she told the bus driver to go on without her. That's when she left on foot and took some money out of her bank account. Then she got on a different bus headed for Snohomish, Washington. She got off the bus near a shopping center in Snohomish and was spotted in a Subway restaurant asking if they had gluten-free bread. They didn't, so Kenna left again on foot, and she hasn't been seen or heard from again. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 236 of The Vanished. Part 2 of Kenna Harris's story. Everyone knows that finding the perfect t-shirt can be a challenge. I've always had problems whether it was with the fit or quality. Luckily, the perfect t-shirt does exist, and you can find it at Skims. From cropped silhouettes to long-sleeve layering tees, there's a style for everyone. You know that I've been wearing Skims for a long time, and recently tried one of their t-shirts. It's the best-fitting tee I've ever worn. Skims makes the best basics and foundations. I got the boyfriend t-shirt in Onyx, and it's so soft and comfortable. I want to wear it every day. It literally fits like a dream. Shop the Skims t-shirt shop at skims.com, now available in sizes extra extra small to 4X. If you haven't yet, be sure to let them know I sent you. After you place your order, select podcast in the survey, and select my show in the drop-down menu that follows. In part one, we learned all about Kenna's struggles with bipolar disorder and her traumatic brain injury. We learned how that made it hard for her to fit in with her peers. Kenna also desperately wanted to be independent, but that goal was difficult for her to achieve. We don't know exactly what happened on March 31st, 2020, but her family has been trying to piece together the clues that Kenna left behind. They know that she took the bus from her home in Monroe and got off in Snohomish because she was seen on video on the bus. After she got off the bus, an employee at a local Subway restaurant remembers her coming in, and then that's it. Kenna just drops off the radar completely. In part one, Kenna's mom Kelly told us about what they've learned happened on March 31st. She told us more about the evening they realized that something was amiss, and how they used Kenna's phone records to find out more information.
She didn't come home from work, and I said, "What's up? Where's Kenna?" And she didn't come home by dinner time, and I said, "Okay, what's up? We ate at 6. And it's okay. She has some friends at work and whatever. So we start calling her phone and that, and it's just going right to voicemail. And I'm like, okay, something's wrong. What's up with that? So 7 o'clock, we called the police and got a newer officer. That was frustrating. Yeah, that didn't really take me seriously. They're like, yeah, okay, lady, yeah, right, your daughter's 25. I'm like, yeah, my daughter has a brain injury and she's 25. So she's like half woman, half girl. She's like 25, but she's really like 14. So yeah, but they still just didn't take me seriously. So the next morning, because now we're like stuck. I mean, we figured out how to go on Find My Phone and we could see the tracking of her phone. And we could see the like the Google Track My Phone told us walking to the Chase and then walking. And then it said she's on a bus. We're like, oh my gosh, she got on a bus. And then she's on the bus for like 10 minutes and boof, nothing. So when we finally got the bus footage, we could see right when she was going down 154th, she's sitting on the bus and she's looking at her phone and she's like flicking at the screen, like something's wrong with it. And then she starts crying. She's wiping away tears a lot. And then she flicks at her phone some more. And then she finally gives up and puts it in her pocket. And that's on the footage right at the time that her phone stopped sending a signal. They think she intentionally turned off her phone because she didn't want to be found. I believe that she was mad. She didn't want to go to work anymore. She was looking to go hang out with some people. She reached out to a guy via text on her phone before it went out and said, I need a place to stay where my parents won't know where I am. Can I stay at your place? And he says, no. And she says, can I sleep on my on your lawn? And he says, no. And that's last texting. And I just know that texting stream because that guy sent it to me. And they've searched his house. He lives with some roommates. And Snohomish County Sheriff's went and searched his place. Yeah, so now I have a TBI girl that unless she wrote down some people's phone numbers and she found another phone or borrowed a phone or something, she has no way to communicate with anybody. I'm pretty sure she has my phone number memorized. Yeah, I know she has my phone number memorized because her phone battery has died before at the YMCA and she'll call me from the lobby.
Thinking about the area where Kenna disappeared, Kelly has become concerned that she may have gotten a ride with someone.
From January 15, 2019 until May of 2019, she worked at the Piltruck Drive-In, which is right down the road from where she disappeared. And she would come home so many times and tell me like, oh, mom, this really nice old man told me what pretty eyes I have, or somebody told me how beautiful I am today. Which those were always like sweet, like little highlight things. I'm like, oh, honey, you are so beautiful and you do have beautiful eyes and stuff. But now it's like, that's one thing I worry that she ran into somebody in that parking lot that she recognized from working at that drive-in. If she's desperate, she doesn't have any place to stay. Her phone just either the battery died. She forgot to pack her backup battery. It's in her room. So her phone either broke or died. Now she doesn't have a place to stay. She's in a parking lot that she's a little familiar with. She's been over there before, but not a ton. What does she do? And all her medication is gone from the house.
There's that one last sighting of Kenna at the subway in Snohomish. They don't have video footage to confirm that the woman was Kenna. But her brother Hunter told us that the fact that she asked for gluten-free bread stands out to him.
We have positive confirmation that she went to the subway in that area, the Snohomish subway next to Fred Meyer, and she asked the individual, hey, do you guys have any gluten-free bread? Because Kenna is on a gluten-free diet. Bread with gluten in it will bother her. And so she primarily eats gluten-free bread. And so she asked the employee at Subway, do you guys have gluten-free bread? And he says, oh, no, I'm sorry. I think they might have ran out. I think Subway usually has gluten-free bread, but they didn't that day. But he says, oh, we ran out or we don't have any more gluten-free bread. And she said, oh, okay, like, that's all right. Dang. And walked out of the store because she was just trying to get something to eat. And she walked out of the store And that was the last time we ever saw her. So my mom went right there. We did a great job, like tracing her down, everything. Went to that Subway, and we got positive confirmation from the employee that was working that day that he had definitely seen her. Because he could describe to us that, like, oh, yeah, that girl came in asking for gluten-free bread. And I mean, so we know he saw Kenna.
After Kenna disappeared, her family began doing everything they could to try to find her. Kenna's sister Cammie told us more about their search efforts.
I helped my mom go really deep in Kenna's phone records. Then we just started making a bunch of flyers and also just reaching out online through social media and through like news sites like Reddit. We posted on there. That's basically it. Just hitting the streets, like just searching under bridges, like walking around the town where Kenna was last seen, walking around Snohomish. And then we just kind of spread out from there. Like people have put flyers up from downtown Seattle to like Orcas Island, and I don't even know where else.
Kenna's mom, Kelly, had mentioned in part one that they initially didn't search the parking lot where Kenna was last seen with tracking dogs, because it had rained heavily and they believed that this kind of search wouldn't yield any clues. As more time passed with no word from Kenna, police did go out and search the area.
After she never came home for a month, and at least a month, search and rescue officers went by themselves with a special dog and searched in the wooded areas around where she was last seen. So I'm guessing that special dog means that it's a dog that smells for dead people. There's so many driveways around there that, like, there's wooded property, like, on the people's property down the driveway. Like, I went to one yesterday that there's two houses on this driveway, and the property itself just has so many woods on it. So I don't know. Did they go and, like, search every one of those places? And then we couldn't call all our friends and say, oh, it's COVID-19 and you're all supposed to be staying home, but we're asking you to come out and search for our daughter. So we didn't feel right about doing that. So some of our friends said, I want to go look on my own. And a lot of our friends have gone and looked on their own, and we've gone and looked, obviously. But some of it's private land over there that's like all fenced. And I don't know if she would. She's not a big camper. We camp a lot in our family. And she doesn't necessarily like camping. And she was not prepared to be out. That was like the spring weather where it was just raining and it was cold. And she was not prepared, nor did she have stuff to survive anything like that. Well, she said either with this friend that she reached out to that said no, or she said, my parents also don't know my friend in Kenmore. But we found that friend's phone number, and we've reached out to her multiple times. And she says she's never heard from her. And that girl's been to our house, too. And she said, no, she says, I wish I had better news for you. Every time I text her, she says, I'm so sorry. She says, I wish I had better news, but I haven't heard from her.
We also spoke to Kenna's aunt, Shawn, who's Kelly's sister. She told us how she learned that Kenna was missing and what her immediate worries were.
My mom called me to tell me that she was missing. And so I just listened, because my mom doesn't always get all of the details correct. And so I just listened, and I didn't ask a lot of questions, because I knew also that she would know some information, but not all of the information. And so then said goodbye to mom. I reassured her it's going to be okay. They're going to find her. And mom was really, really, I mean, she was really getting very, very worked up. And I said, and they will find her. Well, I didn't know about what had happened with the phone, that she had charged it up. I called our younger sister, Erin, and got more details from her then. And then it was just like, oh, it was just this, like someone had just punched me right in my stomach. I thought, oh my gosh, because Kenna can come across in the first moments that you meet her as being really okay. And that's what she tries to do. That's so important to her, to be accepted as someone without a TBI. Someone without bipolar disorder. But if you talk to her for a little bit longer, I'd say 5 to 10 minutes, you're going to know that something is not quite right. She can't track all of the conversation. She she can't quite cognitively process that. And she does a lot of, while she's trying to catch up with what it is that you're saying. And she'll do, oh, really? Just kind of responses, you know, that she has practiced that help her appear to be tracking that conversation. But in reality, she may not be getting all of it. And I worry about her getting in someone's car, because she would. And that's what I think happened. I think somebody stopped because she had her backpack. She had her yoga mat rolled up so she could sleep outside, because she's decided she'd rather do that than go to work at Walmart that day. And somebody might have pulled over. She's so pretty, and said, hey, you know, do you need a ride? And she might have said, maybe. Where are you going? Or she might have said, yeah, kind of like that, kind of how she talks.
There's a possibility that Kenna could be living amongst the homeless population. With her brain injury and memory loss, is it possible that she could be out there and not know who she is, or be unable to find her way home, or even just contact her family and let them know that she's okay? Or maybe she made that choice because she so desperately wanted to be independent.
I think because we have such a large homeless population in the state of Washington, especially the Pacific Northwest, and that the weather right now is not awful, I really do think that she's maybe with homeless people. She talked about homeless people. I think she saw that as like a gypsy adventure or something. I mean, the reality of it, I don't think she had any real concept of, but I'm hoping actually she's with the homeless, because I'm hoping she didn't get in someone's car that took her off somewhere else. I'm hopeful that that's where she is, because I think we'll find her then. I really do.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this, and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. We wanted to know how law enforcement was handling such a complex case. So we spoke to Detective Fontenot with the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office. When we spoke with him, we first asked him to introduce himself.
I'm Detective Dave Fontenot with the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office, which is located in Everett, Washington, which is north of Seattle in Washington State, about 25, 30 minutes north of Seattle. Our agency is the second largest traditional law enforcement agency in the state of Washington, as far as, you know, numbers go and the area. We have a population of just under 1 million in this county that were responsible for law enforcement services. I've been in law enforcement for, this is my 27th year. I've served in every capacity that one generally can in law enforcement. I started on patrol like everyone else, which is responding to 911 calls and having emergent calls for service. So you respond to all kinds of things. I've been in detectives now probably the last 14 years, pretty continuously. I've been in major crimes for 10 years, which is the homicide assault unit is what it's called, major crimes. We also are responsible for missing persons. The reason I got into law enforcement actually isn't to help people necessarily, although I ultimately that's what I was drawn to. I was looking for a career. I was a young man looking for a career at 23, and Pops had just come on TV, which may sound strange, but I thought, man, I could do that. Just so happens fate stepped in and there was a reserve academy that was starting in my in the area where I was living at the time, so I joined the reserve academy. And like any time you find in your life where you find your passion, I found my passion, and that was law enforcement. It was exciting, it was rewarding, and it was also a career. So I've never looked back since then. I've always been drawn to investigations because they're more complex and challenging than some patrol calls. I teach at several training curriculums for the state under the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Commission involving investigations, crime scene management, and the management of complex cases, violent crime. So law enforcement for me is what I do. It is what I do every day. There is no 9-to-5 to this job, which suits me and my style. And particularly in homicide or in major crimes, we are married to the phone and the email. And in this particular case, in the Kenna Harris case, I have worked while I was on vacation. I have worked while I've been driving at places. I have worked overnight. I've taken it upon myself to try to accommodate any tip that has come in. So it's really the dedication part of it. As far as law enforcement goes and investigations, the dedication part to me, to the victims, our motto in major crimes for Snohomish County is the truth never dies. And that is the motto of our unit. And we really, truly believe that. The truth never dies, and we will continue to fight for it and continue to seek it and continue to represent the victims of violent crime and missing persons that we just don't know.
We asked Detective Fontenot to tell us how the Sheriff's Department became aware of Kenna's disappearance and what they did once they received the missing persons report.
The Sheriff's Office received a call. A patrol deputy took the initial call, as they do with all calls for service. And they initiated a report of a missing persons case. In this case, Kenna Harris. I believe the reporting party was the mother. And the circumstances for that report at the time they were provided were not particularly suspicious. The patrol deputy took the information and followed policy and collected some of the information, got some statements, and basically got a knowledge and understanding of what had happened, which was that she had left voluntarily. She was an adult female living with her parents. She was had some physical and mental limitations, although that really wasn't disclosed early on. Mom was sort of holding back on that a little bit, and that could be for a lot of different reasons. 9 times out of 10, missing people are found really quickly, within a few hours, within a few days. In this particular case, so the deputy took the report, filed it with our records per protocol. It was entered into NCIC as a missing person. And so it was entered into that. Our records did it that day, which is our policy. And so it begins. And really, the patrol deputy's not going to do much else other than collect information and get it passed on, because their shift is 12 hours. They're moving on to the next call. There isn't anything particularly emergent. If there had been a component of this that was suspicious to the deputy or an emergent component, then protocol is for the supervisor to recognize that, or the deputy to recognize it, let the supervisor know, and then the supervisor would consult with major crimes. That did not occur in this case because it did not rise to that level. And if they consult with major crimes, sometimes we'll get called out. that day, or it'll be assigned to a detective in the major crimes unit that day. But that is not what happened in this case.
A few days after Kenna's disappearance, Detective Fontenot was assigned to her case. This is when her mom, Kelly, receives some disturbing messages about Kenna.
The reason I got assigned it as soon as I did is Kelly, the mom, had received a message of ransom. And that ransom message patrol, it was the same deputy, as a matter of fact, took the call and recognized, well, now this is very strange. This is really very strange. Maybe we have a crime. And so MCU, our major crimes unit, was consulted. And Sergeant Fenter, my supervisor, it was actually, I want to say it was on a Saturday, he was consulted and he started to work on it. And by work on it, he was like trying to determine whether it was a credible ransom situation, because we would have to take action pretty quickly. And he was able to determine that this might be a phishing or this might be a scam, but I'm not sure. And so he called me Sunday morning. He talked to me at home and said, I need you to look further into this ransom situation and have contact with the family because she hasn't shown up yet. And so it was assigned to me at that point, and I was able to determine within a few hours that the ransom message, such as it was in fact just a scam. There was no substance to it at all. In fact, the same message with a different name had been involved in California, in Oregon, Idaho. Basically, it was a Facebook troll that was just trying to find an easy scam. Frankly, that was the first time I had seen that particular direct, give us money and we'll tell you where your daughter is. That was the first time I'd seen something quite so direct. Oftentimes, as far as scams go, you get people that will prey on the family's grief and guarantee they'll be able to find their loved one or their missing person if only they give them money. This case was, it was straight up ransom. This was, we have your daughter, you will pay us this, and then we'll, you know, she'll be set free. So I immediately took that information from the message. I was able to determine a contact phone number that was associated with it. We have a database system that we utilize, some software that is connected to basically a database of users that are subscribed to this software. It's called CellHawk, that really helps us vet phone numbers and their locations, not necessarily like physical location, but where they come from, how they start, that sort of thing. I was provided information within a few hours that the same message had been sent to those agencies I talked about. I was able to physically talk to those detectives down there and verify that they had also vetted the information and that it was just not credible in any way. So that was shared with the family almost immediately. You know, don't respond to them. Good gracious. Don't pay them money. Don't fall prey. And that was within a few hours of getting that information. I mean, it is not uncommon in missing person cases. The more information that gets out there, especially because of the social media platforms, it is not uncommon for families to receive information from people that, if you give us money, we will give you information. And that can be from psychics to private investigators to just unscrupulous people.
With the ransom situation taken care of, Detective Fontenot continued to work on Kenna's case. We asked him if her disappearance was treated differently because of her medical and mental health issues. This is what he told us.
Is someone with a mental or physical disability treated any differently? It's a component. I mean, obviously, if she was a juvenile, and the mom and I have had this conversation because she's like, well, she is a juvenile mentally, but that's really not how we can approach it because she is an adult and she has the freedom. She has the right to leave. She has the right to go anywhere she wants, but we definitely are sensitive to her limitations because she's not necessarily endangered. Although I have early on articulated to the phone company two different times where I was able to commonly refer to as a ping on a phone to try to ping her phone signal. And I did that with exigent circumstances after I was able to articulate that to T-Mobile. I was only able to do that twice. They won't do it for me again because we are not in an emergent situation. We don't have other information that suggests that it's emergent. So I was able to do that for 15 days at a time twice. And the second time, I knew that I was pushing my limit of what I could ask them to do as far as emergent goes. And we never did get any signal connection. So her phone never connected to the signal. But I did that using that component of mental and physical limitations that gained no traction. So to answer your question fully, it doesn't receive any extra attention, but it's certainly a component of consideration if it's going to escalate to the next level, which would be assignment to a detective.
Kelly told us how they were able to follow the trail of Kenna's first few movements. We asked the detective to tell us more about that and how they were able to track her steps to Snohomish.
The video we have from her taking off, leaving, she takes $230 from the bank. She has access to the bank. It hasn't been touched. $230 is not going to get you very far, but she gets on a bus. She goes to, I mean, we've tracked her on that. We have the video of that. She's packed a bag. She's prepared, more prepared than a lot of people would be. So I think she left voluntarily. I think her disappearance, I would be speculating, but I think the longer it goes, the less likely she's in a situation of wherever she's at, alive or dead or captive or not captive, or however the situation is, the longer it goes, I think the less likely she's in a voluntary situation. But I would say at the outset, because we don't have that criminal component that we talked about or element yet, not to say that we can't develop that, but we're certainly looking at, you know, at this point, if I had to say she's voluntarily on her own, I would say yes. But certainly that would be an asterisk. And I would say we are all anxiously searching and continuing to search databases and electronic footprints to determine whether that voluntariness is continuing.
Detective Fontenot told us about a theory he's considered in Kenna's case.
She's going to run away. She's going to have an adventure. And she goes to do that. And she says, oh, I'm going to work. And off to work she goes. Except she's not that day. She packs a bag. She gets her stuff. She sort of makes this plan. She does reach out to a person she had met, and she says to him, I'd like to live on your lawn. And I sat in front of that guy's apartment. I talked to his neighbors, and then I contacted him. But he said no. And she was upset by that. You can see it on the bus. You can see that. So she's on the bus, and she's not super sophisticated. She's not hiding. She's on the bus. I mean, there's video everywhere. She gets off the bus. She goes to Bickford Station, where she's been before. She's comfortable there. She's not opposed to asking for a ride. Mom's told me that. She's very able. She's open to talking to people. She's not shy. So my feeling is, I don't think she was meeting someone there because I think we would know it. I think what happened is she walked across the parking lot. She sees someone, male, female, old, young, I don't know. And she says, hey, by the way, I'm this nice looking, clean, young person. I really could use a ride. Or maybe they drive her to Everett. Now she's in Everett, which is the main town here, and she can get anywhere. They drop her off the transfer station or transit station, and she could be any place. We have buses, trains, planes, you name it, right? And so from there, there's quite a homeless contingent in the huge, as a matter of fact, in the Everett area. Well, our office of the neighborhoods is a group of guys that they just go through homeless camps every day, all over the county, all the time, every day. You know, she could be anywhere. It looked like she was just running away to have an adventure. Did she have somewhere she wanted to end up? Okay, well, in that case, did she meet someone that just recognized? Because you know predators are going to recognize the easy prey. And I don't think that's the case in Snohomish, because I could be totally wrong. I mean, opportunity, crime of opportunity, but you know, she gets someplace and she meets that perfect manipulator, given the circumstances. I think she somehow met up with someone by chance. I don't think it was planned, but by chance.
Finally, we asked the detective what he would like to share with the public and how anyone with information can contact him.
The sheriff's office, family, every resource that we have tried to utilize has been cooperative and helpful. If I could encourage people to call in a more timely manner, it is my experience, and it's experience in this case, that people see something and they hesitate to say something. And it's easy to say, see something, say something. Call 911. I mean, really. And say, hey, this is not an emergency, but I think I have I think I'm looking at a missing person, and allow that to be vetted. By calling 911, you're not clogging up the system. They will transfer you to a call taker on a non-emergent line, and your information will be shared. Sometimes law enforcement or whoever would be dispatched is in the area. Sometimes they're not, but sometimes they're right there, and the dispatch goes out and the car's right there, and they're able to contact the person and quickly vet the information. So commonly in this case, the tips are begin and end with, well, 2 weeks ago. That's just not super helpful to us. Now, I have pulled video from all over the region. If I get a tip that, hey, I saw this person at the Walmart in whatever city, I've talked to those people. I've got the video. I'm getting a still image of the person they believe it is. And turns out it's just not her. And that's great. I don't mind doing that. That's what my job is. I'm not annoyed by that. Where it starts to hurt the family and makes it difficult for me to tell them as a tip comes in, like one we had yesterday that said 2 weeks ago, I think I saw her at a location talking to someone in a car. None of the descriptions were provided. The actual location really was very vague and it's old. And they also didn't leave their contact information so that I could call them back. It was an anonymous tip. If I was able to tell people, call 911, call right away, ask for a non-emergent line and get that information to someone, it may be the tip that we need, even small tips. I mean, it's a puzzle and every piece counts. The information's out there, the tips are coming in. We haven't found the right tip yet, but that doesn't mean that we can't. It could be something so simple as I found this phone, and maybe a law enforcement agency takes an interest in the phone and they're able to turn it on. And the next thing you know, they turn it on and it, you know, the signal connects and the mom who's keeping the account going, mom gets a notification that, you know, there's been an activation on the phone or bank records. You know, if her debit card is used, we're going to know. That's huge. That's big. And so, I mean, we're poised and ready. We just need just the right moment for it all to come together. There is a reward the family has posted. Crime Stoppers of Washington has added $1,000 to that for information that leads to her discovery in whatever capacity. Crime Stoppers, first of all, and you can remain anonymous. You can be assigned a number. I can tell you that they won't tell us who you are, for sure. I've tried. They are super guarded about that, and I respect that 100% because that's the way we get credible tips, is through that. That is one avenue. If you feel like you see her or have contact with her or have credible information of where she is or where she's been, that we can document that, whether it's a casino or a store or a taxi or whatever it may be, any place, timely, call 911. Report it to your agency, your area agency, and tell them this is a missing persons case. Don't wait. Do it right away, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can remain mostly anonymous in that avenue, although your phone number is going to be recorded and I'm going to have it and there's a good chance I'm going to talk to you. But there's a good chance that, you know, those kinds of timely tips are what we're really seeking. What we don't want is people speculating. And by that, I mean, I get a lot of information where people say, and I'm using air quotes here, I know she is being trafficked. I know she is hiding here. I know she's part of this group or this cult or this thing or that thing. If you're going to say, I know, then be able to back that up with, I know, and here's the reason why. Here's the evidence to support that. Because those tips are distracting. They're not only distracting to law enforcement and take my time from pursuing other credible information, but they also are incredibly distasteful and hurtful to the family because there's no basis for it. And the family grabs on to any glimmer of hope. And that, to me, hurts my heart for them because they call me and they say, someone's online and they're saying they know she's someplace. And I have to tell them in the most gentle way that I can that it's not true. She's not at that place, or she is not in that situation because there's no evidence to support that. And we need to focus on things that we can show and prove. It does hurt my heart every time that they have a situation where they are grabbing onto that hope because someone says, I know, I know. And well, my next question to I know is how, and where do I go to find the same information? If you know it and you can share it, I'm happy to look into it. But if you know it because you watched TV and you watched CSI last night and they said their machine told them something and you just know that that's the case because you feel that I can't go on that. I got to be able to go on solid foundation.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So, if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Imagine upgrading your wardrobe with luxury essentials at unbeatable prices. Quince is here to transform the way you shop with a range of high-quality items priced within reach, like 100% Mongolian cashmere sweaters for $50, organic cotton sweaters, washable silk tops, and timeless 14-karat gold jewelry. The best part, all Quince items are priced 50 to 80% less than similar brands. By partnering directly with top factories, Quince cuts out the cost of the middleman and passes the savings on to us. And I was thrilled to learn that Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. I love that. I now have several items from Quince. I love their cardigans, pants, and shirts. I find their pieces to be easy to mix and match, and also to dress up or dress down. Indulge in affordable luxury. Go to quince.com/vanished for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/vanished to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/vanished. In order to more fully understand what Kenna was dealing with at the time of her disappearance, we wanted to talk to an expert who has experience in working with traumatic brain injuries, as well as patients with type 1 bipolar disorder. For Kenna's story, we brought back Dr. Philip Taft, who has previously contributed to the show. Dr. Taft maintains a practice in Texas and has extensive professional experience. You can find out more information about him in the episode notes. Dr. Taft gave us more information about traumatic brain injuries.
A traumatic brain injury used to be a separate category, and now it goes up under an umbrella that covers all sorts of what's called neurocognitive disorders. And neurocognitive disorders, according to the DSM-5, which is the latest edition of the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, a traumatic brain injury is one of the many types of brain problems or brain diseases that can lead to those disorders. Looking at those criteria, for a person to qualify as having a major neurocognitive disorder, it is evidence of a significant cognitive decline from a previous level of performance. You know, I can think of things like executive functioning, learning and memory, language. Those are things that we would measure as having declined. The individual person has to qualify for a major neurocognitive disorder diagnosis. They have to have concern or a knowledgeable informant. So it could have been like Kenna expressing a concern, or her mom, or another person, or even a clinician, that there's been a significant decline in their cognitive functioning. The second one is that a substantial impairment in their cognitive performance has been documented by a standardized neuropsychological testing or other clinical assessment. And then the next criteria is that the cognitive deficits interfere with their independence and their everyday activities. And these are things that we all just take for granted, but it's like daily living, such as paying your bills, driving a car, making phone calls, counting change back, managing their medications, things like that. So those three criteria, those all have to be met. There is evidence of a traumatic brain injury, so obviously an impact to the head. And so it could be, for example, a car wreck, somebody getting assaulted with a blunt instrument, falling off of a high ladder and hitting your head on the floor. Then beyond that, that's where the criteria get a little looser, is it can be any one of four things following that that also support this diagnosis. One is loss of consciousness, post-traumatic amnesia. Post-traumatic amnesia, you know, everyone knows what amnesia is, and so this is simply forgetting about what happened, not being able to remember what happened because your brain was hit so hard that you can't even recall either what happened before, during, or after. And then disorientation and confusion could be another just one of the criteria that support the diagnosis of TBI. And finally, neurological signs. So obviously things like neuroimaging, showing the injury, onset of seizures that's never happened before. And last criteria on that is the neurocognitive disorder presents immediately after the occurrence of the TBI. And then that makes sense because, you know, that would support that this incident led to this traumatic brain injury. A lot of people think that traumatic brain injury sounds severe. And so they think, well, this person is more going to be like appearing intellectually disabled. And certainly there are a lot of people out there with those major neurocognitive disorder TBIs. There are a ton of people walking around with mild TBIs functioning in everyday life, and it kind of may be in between the mild and major, and they're having problems, but it's not readily observable. So these are going to be like your NFL football players or people who've been in sports all their life. They've had concussions over and over and over again, and a concussion is a mild TBI. So to me, that's the most common misperception, is that, you know, you can see it, it's easily observable because traumatic brain injury sounds so bad, but a mild concussion repeated over time can create incredible problems for a person with their brain and how it's functioning, with how they're able to remember things, without how they're able to communicate, with their mood. You know, we know that it leads in some cases to suicide because of all the difficulties associated with repeated mild TBIs.
Dr. Taft also explained to us what type 1 bipolar disorder is and how it affects those who have been diagnosed with it.
Now, the criteria for bipolar 1 are broken down into having to meet two separate mood problems. The first mood problem is a problem with what's called mania or a manic episode. And just so that kind of everyone understands what a manic episode is, you'll never forget if you've ever met with somebody with who is in the midst of a manic episode, because you're going to believe that this person who you formerly knew as, you know, quite normal is shockingly different. It's defined as a distinct period of abnormally and persistently elevated, expansive, or irritable mood that is abnormal and persistent. We see things like increased goal-directed activity, such as starting a whole bunch of projects all at once, increased energy levels, and it has to last at least 1 week and be present most of the day, nearly every day. So that's something that really is way beyond moody. And then the second stage of the criteria for a manic episode are during the period of mood disturbance that we just defined and increased energy or activity, you have to have three or more symptoms, and those criteria are inflated self-esteem or grandiosity. So I'm on top of the world, you know, we're thinking Titanic, you're on front of the ship, you know, your arms are spread and all of your problems are solved, and you're like that for a week straight. And the next criteria is decreased need for sleep. So they feel fully rested after maybe just a few hours of sleep. Whereas normally, if you only get a few hours of sleep, you're exhausted. And remember, that lasts for a week. More talkative than usual, or what we call pressured speech. So it's like there's no downtime. There's no moment of pause. There's no social reciprocal exchange. They're literally talking very loudly and right up in your face, and their space, their body space awareness may not be there at all, telling you about all of the fantastic things that have come to mind for them. The fourth criteria is flight of ideas or a subjective experience. People will report their thoughts are racing. And the people that I've worked with and encountered in a manic episode will say, my thoughts are racing so fast, I can't even keep up with them. And so it's like a movie in fast forward. The next one is distractibility. So like this is a person that looks severely ADHD. Their attention is so easy to switch to like anything, maybe totally unimportant or irrelevant. And people will observe this. They may not realize how distractible and bouncing from thing to thing they are. The sixth one is increased focus in goal-directed activity.
As we listen to Dr. Taft describe the diagnostic criteria for type 1 bipolar disorder, it reminded us of many of the behaviors that Kenna's family had described to us, and also made us wonder how this could have factored into her decision to walk away on that fateful day in March. Dr. Taft explained the rest of the basis for a bipolar diagnosis.
Lastly is excessive involvement in activities that have a high potential for painful consequences. So this would be things like they run out and spend their credit cards to the max. They run to a casino and they gamble into a position where they're in trouble. So those are the seven criteria. They only have to have three or more if they're in an inflated self-esteem state or a grandiose state. Four or more if they're irritable. And then it moves on to say that the mood disturbance is sufficiently severe to cause marked impairment. And this is almost always the case with every mental health condition. It has to cause marked impairment in social or occupational functioning. So, you know, it could even necessitate a hospitalization to prevent harm to self or others in the case of mania, especially if they become psychotic, because some people in a manic state do become psychotic. They see things that aren't there. They hear voices that aren't, no one else hears. And they have delusional thoughts, you know, that can include things like paranoia or that they're some celebrity or Jesus Christ himself. So it has to cause that marked impairment in like their relationships or their job. And then lastly, this is always true of the DSM-5. It can't be caused by something else like, you know, use of cocaine or methamphetamine. It can't be due to another or different disorder. So that's manic episode. Now, bipolar is bipolar because it's two poles. So we have mania or hypomania on one side, and that's the up mood, right? And then on the other side, we have major depressive episode, which is the downside, the other pole. So some people have strictly major depressive disorder, but a bipolar person has both mania or hypomania, and they have cycles of depression.
We heard from those that we talked to that Kenna experienced many of the symptoms Dr. Taft described relating to both traumatic brain injuries and bipolar disorder. But these are challenges that we can't even imagine grappling with unless we have them. There are many misconceptions out there about bipolar disorder. These misconceptions often shape how society views or judges people, and can also undermine the severity of living with bipolar disorder. Dr. Taft explained some of these misconceptions.
Everyone thinks they have bipolar disorder just because they're moody, or everyone thinks their spouse has bipolar disorder just because, you know, their mood is very unstable. But we see there's extensive criteria that has to be met. So that's probably the most common one, is that it's far more prevalent than it really is. I've heard other misconceptions about that disorder, bipolar 1, in that people view them as weak or somehow mentally flawed. They don't view it as a mental health condition. They view it as something to be ashamed of or embarrassed by. And I think we could put most mental health issues into that category. I think that's changing. But when you have a severe disorder like bipolar 1 disorder, it's physically like living with some type of cancer that you can live your lifetime with, or maybe a severe form of diabetes. You know, you can live your life with it, but you really have to manage it. I think the third thing is people judge people with bipolar 1 disorder quite a bit because they don't like to comply with their treatment. And the reason is they don't want to be on medications that lead them to feeling like a zombie. They lose their pleasure when they're on these mood stabilizers a lot of times. Because of that, they tend to try to get off their medication. They end up having another manic episode. And it's so hard for those who love them because it creates such disruption in the home, in a relationship, and even can lead to incarceration. So there's just a lot of judgmentalism going on, I think, with bipolar 1 disorder. I think a whole lot more compassion and understanding could be used in understanding this disorder.
Kenna's brother Hunter talked about the ECT treatments that Kenna was receiving. He told us that she seemed to dread these treatments. We wanted to know more about ECT treatments and how they work. Dr. Taft explained them further.
ECT is something that we used to do 40, 50 years ago. We would shock somebody in a controlled way in their brain to try to stimulate them out in a very severe way of a depressive episode. And this is utilized nowadays in a much healthier way for only the most severe cases of bipolar disorder that cycle into long periods of very severe depression or major depressive disorder that is a recurring disorder and very damaging to that person's life. What we believe there is to shock their brain through this therapy is better than leaving them at the behest of this horrible disorder, you know, where they could take their life, because bipolar disorder is often terminal because of the activities that people engage in that can be very destructive to themselves and others. And depression, major depressive disorder, is obviously terminal in that suicide is often the end result of it. So nowadays when they do ECT, and I've actually worked with patients who came back to me after several rounds of electroconvulsive therapy, and their brains are not damaged by it in a severe way. And a lot of times they come back and they're actually living life again. They're returning to kind of their old self before the disorder really took hold of them. Back 40, 50 years ago, maybe even 30 years ago, when a person went through ECT, a lot of times it really changed who they were. The mechanism for the shock treatment was damaging, but it was still better than them being in a state of suffering from major depression that is not tolerable.
We also asked what some of the other mainstream treatments are for type 1 bipolar disorder. In order to gain a better understanding of what some of Kenna's medications may have been and how they may have made her feel, Dr. Taft hasn't treated Kenna personally, but he shared with us what he knows from his experience working with patients who have this type of bipolar disorder.
Bipolar 1 disorder is often a crisis type disorder. In other words, when you go into a manic episode, full-blown mania, I guess one of the major treatments is hospitalization. And that's when a person meets the criteria of being potentially a severe risk of harm to self or others. So you'll often see people in a hospital with bipolar disorder, with major depression, with schizophrenia, and then they're released back out into the community for outpatient therapy treatment when they're stable. And how do they get stable? They do group therapy, individual therapy, and they do medication treatment. And that giving them kind of that little nest to protect them from stressors, we call that milieu therapy. That helps them to stabilize and then return back to their families and the community. The number one treatment for bipolar disorder, whether it's type 1 or type 2, is psychiatric medication. That is the most significant change that you will see in someone with bipolar disorder. And they are, though I'm not a psychiatrist, they are often placed on medications prescribed by a primary care doctor or psychiatrist for mood stabilization. We call them mood stabilizers. They're very effective in most people, and there's a wide variety of them for a psychiatrist or a primary care doctor to prescribe. So what we know is when we combine medication and psychotherapy, we have the best outcomes for most mental health conditions because the person is not only getting a chemical stabilization of their mental health complication or disorder, but they're also getting that ongoing support, learning to develop coping skills, having a safe place to process their thoughts and feelings so they don't have to be alone with it. Therapists are people who went through special training to know how to help and who should be really good at listening, reflecting, and validating, and then helping you to grow your self-care. So growing your self-care along with that medication can lead to a very stable life, even with bipolar disorder.
Finally, we asked Dr. Taft to share with us what he believes someone managing a traumatic brain injury as well as a severe mental health disorder would be dealing with and how that would affect their day-to-day life, as we know Kenna faced.
Major neurocognitive disorder has a much more guarded prognosis. Depending on the extent of the brain injury and what it's affected, that can require tremendous amounts of rehab. People with a major TBI can even lose their ability to speak and have to relearn speech and to recognize objects. They may have lost significant amounts of their executive brain functioning. That's located in their prefrontal cortex. That results in problems with things like managing time, paying attention, switching focus, planning and organizing, remembering details, avoiding saying or doing the wrong thing. You can't regrow executive functioning a lot of times. I think that when you have a major neurocognitive disorder, the prognosis is guarded and oftentimes very poor. They can learn to live life, but it's going to be a very different life. They are going to need supports from family members. They're going to need high structure in their life. They are probably not going to be left to their own devices. Bipolar 1 disorder has a very mixed prognosis, in my opinion. If you put it on a continuum, we could say kind of that mild bipolar 1 disorder, moderate bipolar 1 disorder, we're going to see if a person is willing to comply with their treatment, we're going to see pretty good prognosis. They're going to be able to hold a job. Usually a person with bipolar 1 disorder can be very successful in holding a career, a stable career. They may be a very intelligent person. They might be a professor. They might be somebody who does something very sophisticated. You would never know that they have bipolar 1 disorder unless you were in their inner circle or they decided to tell you. But severe bipolar 1 disorder has a very poor prognosis, and mainly because, just like anything, if you have severe cancer, severe diabetes, severe heart disease, you know, just the chances of you overcoming that disorder, that disease process, are far, far less. So a person with severe bipolar 1 disorder is going to have more frequent hospitalizations, more frequent episodes of depression or of mania. They're going to have all of the areas of their life disrupted, such as relationships, could end in divorce. It could end in incarceration. That happens a lot. People with bipolar 1 disorder that on the severe level, the legal system is trying to do a better job of handling mental illness and drug addiction and separating that from someone with just purely criminal intent. But a lot of times, this is somebody who jumped in a car and smashed into and killed an innocent family. And so now they're in a position where the legal system is involved, and so they literally lose their ability to be free in society. So that's kind of my opinion about that. I think far more people with bipolar disorder are able to live fairly normal lives. That major neurocognitive disorder, that you're going to be able to observe them as looking and behaving very different. They may appear to people as having a speech problem. They're certainly going to struggle with those executive functions I was mentioning, executive brain functioning. And they're going to need a lot of support to live their life. They're probably not going to go back to work. They're probably going to be disabled. To recover those brain functions when it's been so severely damaged is very unusual, very rare. It might happen more often in a young child rather than somebody who is in their adult stage of life. So we could say teenage and on up. Once you've had a major neurocognitive disorder due to traumatic brain injury, the prognosis is very poor that you're going to live a normal life. We just haven't found anything to help somebody recover from that type of brain damage. Extensive rehab early on certainly helps with outcomes. And so it's impossible to say across the board, hey, if you have a major neurocognitive disorder, you're not going to live a normal life. That's not a fair statement. But if you have a major neurocognitive disorder due to traumatic brain injury and you are treated and rehabbed at an intense level and there's other factors such as youth in play, maybe, you know, you had a high level of intelligence before and it didn't really hit some of those key executive function areas, depending on where the brain was injured, yes, there are people that do recover successfully and live a very normal life, but it's kind of like bipolar 1 disorder. When you're in that severe category, you know, it's just fewer and far between. You know, I just was fascinated by Kenna's bipolar break and, you know, the fact that, you know, she, I guess one of the things that I would love to do, and y'all are probably going to do this, is, you know, just kind of apply what we're talking about to Kenna. And just, you know, seeing you had this young woman who was very high functioning before this manic episode hit. Apparently she was an English tutor and she was excellent at French and she was a, you know, high grade earner and an athlete, kind of a superstar. You know, what we really look at is go, wow, that young woman is really going somewhere. And then the tragedy is that she has most likely a manic episode. And so she's up and in everyone's face and they're like, go away. And, you know, you need to go to bed. And we don't know what she was thinking, the night that she took the car, but she jumped into the car, went to her grandmother's house. And then whatever's going on in her head, she jumps in that car and, you know, smashes into something at 80 miles an hour. And that leads to the next great tragedy of her life, which is this major neurocognitive disorder. Looking at the reports from Harborview Medical Center, there is no doubt she had a major neurocognitive disorder because they're talking about extreme or severe losses in her brain functioning that were lasting long periods of time after the original accident. And so what started out as a mental health problem turned into a severe physiological, cognitive, and mental health problem.
With law enforcement still investigating Kenna's disappearance, her family also holds out hope that Kenna will return. The search for Kenna continues, and her family keeps hoping that their search efforts will pay off, and that they will soon be bringing Kenna home. Her sister Cammy shared with us how the family manages Kenna's disappearance as the days continue to pass.
My mom is just like, she's a super mom. She is good at fixing everything. This woman can fix everything. She's like the most capable, powerful, determined person that I know. And yeah, and she really threw herself headfirst into Kenna's recovery. And she had, and same with this situation, you know, she's like, there's a problem with someone I love. Like, I'm going to do everything I can to fix it. And there's a lot that she can do because she's just that strong. There's a lot of the times where she doesn't, you know, like when we have our family meetings where we brainstorm about what to do next with Kenna and everything that we have been doing. There's been times where she's had huge breakdowns. But with this, I just think that she wants to be so clear about all the facts. She wants to like just spread the word as clearly as she can because she knows that's what's going to bring Kenna home. And she's just so focused on that. Does that make sense? She like swallows it all down so she can be so present to do everything she can to get Kenna home. We didn't realize how serious this was going to be and how long this was going to go on for at the beginning. After a couple days of not hearing for her, that's when the panic and the terror really set in for our family. Just kind of thinking, like, who could she have ran into, I guess? Because she was in a town where she's had jobs there. She's worked in that town. She has little connections there. But we also know that she hadn't called anyone that lived in the neighborhood because we went back in her phone records for like days and days contacting everyone. So I guess it was kind of just being like, who could she have possibly ran into? And like, what cameras can we find? Where can we go to find any images of where Kenna possibly went? I hope that someone good is taking care of her and that she's somewhere where she's happy and safe. And that's why we're not hearing from her. But then the other side is that like she's someone bad has her and she's trapped or she's dead. I don't know where else she would be. And I actively work like every moment of the day to keep that hope alive. And I have other friends who are doing the same thing and keep telling me, Cammie, like, she's alive. Like, I feel her out there somewhere. Like, she hasn't left us. So that gives me hope.
Kenna's Aunt Shawn has a message for her niece if she's out there somewhere listening.
No matter how far away you are, you are always connected to your nieces and nephews, looking at it from an aunt's perspective, and being a mom also, and just trying to be there for my sister, even from a distance, and then sharing with her, finally, I wanted to be strong, but then I shared, I have trouble sleeping at night. It's when it's dark that it's the most difficult of all. And we're texting, and it's like 2 a.m, and she said, I didn't know that you were going through that. I said, I didn't want you to know. She said, yeah, I have trouble at night too. And for all of those moms and grandmas and aunts and sisters and fathers and family member, I don't know what it is about when the sun sets, but it just gets darker and more real, and it's hard. But the sun comes up. It always comes up, and it's going to come up for Kenna. I really believe that. She's had one miracle in her life in surviving her car accident, but there's no limit on miracles. And we are praying. We are praying for our second miracle for Kenna, because even with the challenges and the things that are more difficult about her personality and meeting her needs, we as a family are up for that challenge. We don't want to go through our lives without that challenge. I don't want to go home and not be able to be with Kenna. I can't imagine my life not having her in it, because she's interesting and funny and vibrant and fun. She's Kenna. There's just no one like her in the whole world. And I can't wait to wrap my arms around her again.
So what happened to Kenna Harris when she left her home on March 31st? Why did she only take a small backpack with some of her things without telling anyone she wanted to leave? Was she planning to meet someone in secret? Did she have ambitions to start over somewhere and live on her own? What was going through her mind that day? Was this something that was planned or just a spur-of-the-moment decision? Could she be out there living amongst the homeless? Or is it possible that she met a stranger that day? Kenna's medical and mental health challenges add a whole layer of complexity to her disappearance and pose so many questions. We know that on the day that she left, she told the bus driver to go on without her, and that she wasn't going to work that day. We also know that she walked to a local bank where she withdrew a couple $100. Kenna then used local transit to travel to Snohomish, Washington. She was last seen on surveillance footage heading towards a shopping center, and a Subway employee in that shopping center remembers her coming in and asking for gluten-free bread, something that would have been typical for Kenna to ask for. After that, surveillance footage from the shopping center only picked up a figure police think may have been Kenna, but the footage wasn't clear enough to be certain. Her phone died, was shut off, or lost signal, and has not been reconnected to cell towers since. Despite extensive search efforts by family, friends, and law enforcement, Kenna has not resurfaced in nearly 4 months. At the time of her disappearance, Kenna Harris was 25 years old. She's approximately 5'8" tall and weighs around 180 pounds. She has blue-green eyes and a long scar along her spine. Kenna suffers from memory loss and continues to struggle with the injuries she's received over the years. If you have any information about the disappearance of Kenna Harris, please contact your local law enforcement agency or the Snohomish County Sheriff's Office at 425 425- 888-388-3845. You can follow Kenna's story on social media at Please Find Kenna Harris.
And she was just amazing and artistic. Oh my gosh, she could paint and draw and work with charcoal and do pencil drawings. And she would get things out to show me things she had done before. And that artistic ability is still there, but she doesn't do as much as she did before, and it's not as colorful as it was before. Seems like it's darker now when she does do something. It's a darker picture. I think remembering all the things that she could do before and just wanting so much to be that person she was before the accident, before the onset of the true manifestation of the bipolar, where it was just out of control. That girl that went off to college that first year with her long blonde hair and her beautiful smile, and in an apartment with roommates, other girls, and taking classes and doing well. I know she remembers that girl and wants to be her again. And it's very frustrating. I just can't even imagine what that would be like for her.
That brings us to the end of episode 236. I'd like to thank everyone who spoke with us for this story. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to join in on the discussion, there's a page and discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe now and leave a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support the show? There are a couple things that you can do. One way to help The Vanished is by supporting our sponsors. You can find links and promo codes in the episode notes. Another way to support the show is by contributing on Patreon, where you can get early and ad-free episodes. Join me next time. I'll be covering a case from Oregon. Thanks for listening.
This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop Popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels, a symphony of just 3 simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.
Business can mean a lot of things. For some, it's earning reports, the top MBA program, investments, but business isn't everything we do. Side hustles that explode into the next billion-dollar company.
I need to create my own product that I control what the marketing is for.
Unconventional ideas that change the world we live in.
AI is everywhere, with venture capital pouring in.
From Elon Musk,
he took a massive axe and swung it through Twitter's workforce.
To Taylor Swift,
she is unstoppable as her Eras Tour stimulated local economy.
Your favorite coffee shop down the street to the vacation house you rented last weekend. Whatever business means to you, Wondery is the destination for business podcasts. Listen to top business shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Everything from top daily news.
There was more ranch dressing sold last year than ketchup and barbecue sauce.
We're buying the dip, literally.
To deep dives on the biggest successes and failures of our time.
20,000 people lost their jobs.
Wondery means business.